AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion, and by Chevrolet, Chevy runs deep.
This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy for May 25, 2012. Ding dong, the Buick guy's here. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLine.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2200 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website.
Well, thanks for joining us, folks, and I'll say thank you for joining us with Mr. Peter DeLorenzo, the auto extremist, too.
John, great to see you.
Good being here. And we've got Gary Vasilash from Automotive Design and Production Magazine. Great always having you back on the show, too, Gary.
Yes, always good to see Gary because he brings notes.
He comes prepared.
And we'd like to thank Jack Davis, a.k.a. Roaster Jack, for sending us a fresh supply of his coffee, only he's gone a step further and done an AutoLine After Hours blend. It's called a 151 blend. Hammer down, high speed, dark roast.
All right. I love it.
Thanks, Jack. And if you want some great coffee, go to greatnoroco.com, right?
Yeah, greatnoroco.com, right.
Up in Traverse City.
And order you up some AutoLine After Hours coffee.
Yeah, really.
Hammer down, high speed, dark roast. I love it. That's really cool.
So thanks again, Jack. Yeah. Appreciate it.
So you had an interesting column this week, this whole brouhaha over Facebook. Not the IPO, which the rest of the world was focused on, but GM saying, we're not going to advertise on Facebook anymore. And Ford going, wait a minute, we think Facebook's great.
Well, it was the paid component of Facebook. GM still spends around $30 million a year on all the other stuff they do on Facebook. So it's not like they said,
they didn't abandon it completely, yeah. No.
But there's a paid component. And from what I understand, there were a couple meetings, and Facebook didn't do a very good job of convincing GM that there was any ROI for their $10 million of paid component Facebook advertising. So, and then, you know, Ford, of course, is, you know, they're all in to social media of any kind. And they said, well, we're going to continue. And, you know, my point was, you know, first of all, the American car companies have been saddled with this moniker of being terminally on hip for 30 years at least. And so on the one hand, they're like, you know, damned if they do, damned if they don't. If they jump in, you know, blindly and just, you know, because they don't want to be termed as being on hip. So I think the tendency is, we got to be there. We don't know if it works. We think it does. Maybe it doesn't. There's buzz, you know, but we got to be there because if we're not, they're going to say we're too stupid to understand what's going on. But I guess I have to applaud GM for Joe Alwanek for just saying, you know what, time out on this. You know, we're not seeing what you guys are suggesting we're supposed to see here. So it's kind of a ballsy move on their part.
Well, not only that, making this announcement literally just days before the IPO.
Yeah, well, I think there's some friction between the parties.
You know, if they wanted to be hip, they would have said, we're going over to Google Plus.
Yeah. Or as we discussed earlier, now we're going over to Pinterest.
Yeah. No, I've never heard of that. What's Pinterest?
It's this website where you post your...
It's the new Facebook and other
notes.
It's like a corkboard.
Yeah, it's like a corkboard.
That's the whole notion.
That's the mentality.
You're pinning things to it, so you're bringing things there and pinning things what your interests are. So that's the name of the site.
But, you know, the gist of my column was... Yeah, some auto manufacturers, and I'm not just talking about domestic, some auto manufacturers fully embrace the social media space almost to their detriment. I mean, they're throwing money at all kinds of things. And others are kind of being a little more reserved, marching to a different drummer, saying, actually having the temerity to ask, are we really getting anything for this? And that's kind of gutty. But at the end, it's all about the product. If you have the product,
right,
then, you know, you can promote that product in various media any way you like, but you gotta have the product first.
Well, you have to have the product, and you have to have a message that resonates. And so
exactly.
you can have barrelfuls of money and not spend it well.
Yeah.
So I mean, as you well know, that there are people that are not crafting good messages visually and textually, and therefore, you know, it doesn't matter where it is. I saw an airplane flying with a banner on it when I was driving to the studio this afternoon. I was thinking, well, you know, there are some people who still find that as a means of communication. It may work, may not work. But just to be on Facebook, I mean, I think that, you know, being there isn't enough. You've got to make it.
Yeah, and GM, like I said, they're spending $30 million in that neighborhood to, you know, for their four divisions to be on Facebook and do things on Facebook. It's just that there's a paid component that Facebook has been trying to develop, which, matter of fact, is, you know, based, you know, a lot of the stock buzz was, can Facebook monetize what they do? You know, that's where the growth is. If they can't do that, then, you know.
Yeah, then the shares aren't worth what they're going for.
No, apparently they're not anyway. But, that's,
but you know, going back to what you were saying of having great product, I agree. That's the prerequisite. I mean, I don't care how good your advertising message is. If you don't have great product, you're not going to go very far. But, you know, I look at some cars that I think are quite good that are just dead in the water right now. My favorite example is probably the Suzuki Kizashi, which I think is quite a good small car. Actually came out 2 years ago. It's gone nowhere. I mean, absolutely nowhere, because they don't have the money to spend to market.
Well, I think Suzuki, if you know something about Suzuki, their chairman is just a cantankerous old coot, and they decided they weren't going to market here, or, you know, whatever they were spending was too much. And, yeah, the Kizashi's, how do you say Kizashi?
Yeah.
I liked it.
Yeah.
So my take on that car is that it's a good car, okay? And there are lots of good cars.
There's a lot of good cars.
And so you look at the price point, you know, it's 25, 26 grand.
I don't even think it's that
much. No, it was... Because and you know, because you have the four-wheel drive system in there, but I mean, it was just, you know, my sense of it was that this is a prime example of death in the middle. I mean, it's not aspirational enough, and it's not inexpensive enough.
Well, plus,
and
I agree, good car. But I don't think Suzuki has done any sort of a job in establishing the fact
that they sell cars.
Yeah, why Suzuki?
Right.
I mean,
in this country
for cars.
Right.
I mean, they just haven't. So it doesn't matter how good it is. I just don't think the Suzuki as a brand in terms of automobiles, they're dead in the water here.
Well, I don't get it because, you know, the R-Wagon, Suzuki R-Wagon, has been a perennial bestseller in Japan. They dominate the Indian mm-hmm. market in conjunction with, who is it, Maruti? I think it's Maruti. Anyway, whoever they're in conjunction with. They're going strong in China, too, I think. I mean, Volkswagen and them are in a big spat, but I don't know why. They've never been able to crack the code.
Well, I mean, the one that I wonder about is, and, you know, in there were news this week about it as well, the look at Mazda in this market, you know, and the deal that they signed for the MX-5 with Fiat or Alfa. Their cars are really good, but
that has great cars. I think they're very good cars. Maybe I shouldn't say great, but very, very competent cars. And they just don't go anywhere.
Right.
Sales work.
I mean, think of the Mazda 6. When does that ever come up in conversation?
I know.
I mean, people talk about the Accord and the Camry and the Malibu and the Fusion.
You know, and this is a car company that's courted the enthusiast. They support grassroots racing. They've done a tremendous job, really, on behalf of enthusiasts in this country. Mazda has decided to support formula racing in this country.
Well, they claim on any given Sunday there are more Mazdas being road raced. I think that's
right.
A key, road race,
mm-hmm.
than any other brand there is.
And they've done a great job at that, but it hasn't translated. And they have great products. But I'll tell you what, it's just a fine little dance of this marketing, you know. And in Suzuki's case, they didn't spend any money.
Right.
You know, they just say, well, you buy our cars, they're good. No, it doesn't work that way. Mazda, you know, this new campaign they have, I think, is pretty good. They have a new agency. But they just can't get any traction in the market.
I think part of their problem is this Skyactiv name that they're using.
I think that's just deadly. That's just dead in the water. It's just like, what are you doing?
Right. Because the whole ad is trying to explain what Skyactiv means. If you've got to spend a whole ad trying to explain that, you're never going to get
traction. Well, I mean, you know, is it the flying car market that we haven't discovered yet? I don't know. But it's just, it's not a buzz brand, buzz name. You know, on the other hand, Ford's, look at what they've done with EcoBoost. I mean, people actually, it's their moniker for direct injection, turbocharged, like everybody else has, but they've managed to stumble upon this moniker that people actually remember and understand there's a connection. But Skyactiv?
Yeah. Well, I was driving the new Altima this week, which I can't talk about. And I was behind.
Except for your driving impression.
I thought it was everything.
No. Only driving impressions.
Okay. But this is sort of a quasi-driving impression because I was behind one, and they have like a moniker, Pure Blue or something like that, which is their little symbol for highly efficient vehicles. And so you have this whole proliferation of these things. Now, in the case of Mazda, it's more holistic, and they're trying to get that message across, which is sort of engineering geek stuff that I don't think people really care about.
Yeah, no, it's amazing. Like, BMW has what, blue efficiency, I think is what they call it.
And somebody has blue motion.
And blue motion, that's Volkswagen? Mercedes, I think.
Mercedes.
See, I mean, this is what we pay attention to.
Well, but that's another case of the manufacturers. If they think, well, if we don't have something, it's bad. But reality, BMW, ultimate driving machine, still. Mercedes, well, it was engineered like no other car in the world, and then meandered around in the wilderness, and now it's the best or nothing. You know, whether they have blue this or blue that or green this or green that, that it's kind of like they're talking to themselves. You know, we have to have it. If we're not, if we don't, someone might accuse us of being not cool. I don't know.
Not green.
Not organic.
What do you guys think? Oh, sorry.
No,
go ahead.
I mean, to your point of you know, BMW on message, and this annual survey came out this week. The Brand Z top 100 most valuable global brands. And
what are the top 10?
Apple, IBM, Google, McDonald's, Microsoft, Coca-Cola, Marlboro, AT&T, and China Mobile.
So this is a global survey?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And nine of the top 10 are American? That's amazing.
Oh, no, you have Apple, and you have IBM, and you have Google, and you have McDonald's.
No, Microsoft. But that's what I'm saying. Those are all American brands.
Correct. On a
global basis, nine of the top 10 are U.S. That's amazing.
So the first car company is at 23, and it's BMW, and basically it in effect swapped places with Toyota, and Toyota's at 28, but Mercedes is at 46.
Ooh,
well, you get to. Honda's at 65. Nissan's at 81.
Where's Chevrolet?
Volkswagen's at 96.
Wow, that's surprising to me.
They just, and in fact, VW just entered the list of the top 100 this year. So year on year, car companies are down overall 7%, just as, oddly enough, telecom providers. So, you know, we all love our cell providers.
Yeah, that's right.
But no American companies, car companies.
That doesn't surprise me at all. Number one, they were hated before the bankruptcy. Now they're remembered for the bankruptcy.
But this is global, though, so it wouldn't just be here.
Yeah, I know. Right. But
well, that's why, you know, Joel Iwanek and GM Marketing is on a huge push for Chevrolet as a global brand. But they got a long way to go.
Sure they do.
I mean, to see Volkswagen just dipping into the top 100, that surprised me because they're so successful.
Mm-hmm.
But they're successful with all their brands, not necessarily Volkswagen.
Right. Volkswagen is not necessarily a standout brand, even though Volkswagen Group is a standout corporation.
Yes.
Going back to the Fiat Mazda thing, Gary, do you think that's going to go beyond this sports car joint venture that so far they've only signed a memorandum of understanding?
Well, no, Sergio already said today, he said, oh, we're willing to build Mazdas for Mazda whenever, wherever. You know, don't forget, Sergio's always got a plan here. And remember, he's the one who said there will only be five car companies, something like that, yeah, by 2020. This is Sergio's plan to take over Mazda.
Well, I mean,
eventually.
I mean, you look at the scale of Mazda, and I mean, they need to be working with someone. And now that the Ford thing has gone away and faded from view, you know, developing things like the aforementioned SkyActiv Technologies is not a trivial undertaking, and there's a lot of engineering that goes into that. And so you have to amortize those costs over a large number of vehicles, and I mean, let's face it,
they
don't make a lot of vehicles, and therefore,
not on the
how
grand
do you
scale of the industry? Right, I think I want to say they made about 1.5 million vehicles last
year.
Well,
is Sergio still sticking to his thing that they're gonna be selling 6 million vehicles by 2014?
I think he's backed off that because clearly Fiat is not going to be able to pull its fair share of the load.
Right.
And, you know, there's no guarantee that the engineering group at Mazda and the engineering group at Alpha, Fiat, Chrysler, whoever is involved, it's going to immediately just click and everything's going to be beautiful.
Oh, but my reading of the release, though, it seems to me that basically all of the engineering is going to be done for the underpinnings by Mazda, and that Fiat's just going to put an Alpha top hat on it, that it's going to be completely separate. So the car would be basically the MX-5.
Somehow I think there'll be more discussion and interaction than that.
Well, you know, I read this as they're sticking their toe in the water and see, can we get along? Can we at least, you know, like you say, Gary, can we, Fiat, work together with Mazda successfully enough to put a top hat on a car? Do we like the way that we work together? And then I would believe it's going to be, okay, what's the next step? And then what's the next step and the next step? But I think you're right, Peter. I think Sergio Marchionne would love to take over Mazda.
Sure he would.
They don't have an Asian component to the Fiat Chrysler group. Mazda desperately needs a new partner. So my read is, let's play around with a sports car, figure out if things gel well. If they do, then we'll take it to another level.
Yeah, because, you know, Sergio said we'd be swimming in alphas by 2014.
Yeah.
We'll see.
As you look at your watch, right, they're not on schedule for that. Uh-huh. That's exactly right. Hey, we ought to take our first commercial break and invite our guest for the show, Craig Byerly from Buick GMC, coming on. But Ben, let's give a shout-out to our friends at Bridgestone. And joining us right now, as I said, is Craig Byerly, the marketing manager for Buick and GMC. And great having you on the show with us.
Good to be here.
Yeah.
Welcome, Craig.
Thank you.
So, why Buick? Why now?
Why Buick? Why now? You know, I mean, 100-year-old brand. What we're really doing right now is we're trying to drive reappraisal of this brand. We're trying to make people think differently about this brand. We embarked a couple years ago, really after the Enclave had launched, before the LaCrosse launched, and said, you know what, how can we reposition this brand? How can we get this on people's radar? One of the choices that we had to make was, and it was code in the system that we worked on, was, you know, we talked about the loyalists and building cars that pleased the loyalists. What we had to do was figure out a way that we could still build cars that loyalists wouldn't be off-put by, but would also appeal to people like us, people who like to drive, people who like technology in cars. And so that's really what we tried to do over the past couple of years. We've had some success. I think we have a lot more work to do, but we're encouraged by it.
So design is going to be a strong component for Buick. It has to be, right?
Yeah, I mean, design is an absolutely critical part of what we've been able to do. The reason why the Enclave, the reason why the LaCrosse have been so successful is that people really are, the design is so compelling to people.
Well, yeah, and we've talked about the LaCrosse still looks good.
Still looks good. And it's not just that the design is compelling. These things look like Buicks. I mean, if you look at it, you go, what else could it be? It's got to be a Buick.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the unmistakable design, but very, very premium, very beautiful, very sculptural in terms of what we try to do in terms of design. That's absolutely key and a part of our DNA.
So the dichotomy comes in when you have, like you said, you have to embrace the loyalists, but only up to a point.
Who are the loyalists?
The loyalists are people who are...
Let's put it this, old people.
On their last car.
We've overtrained a lot on age. We've talked a lot about age, and we as an organization a couple years ago are to blame for some of that as well. What we're really focused on doing is finding a new audience for this brand, okay? It's generating conquest business.
Which is why you do things like the Regal GS Turbo.
Correct. I mean, there's really five pieces to what we think makes a great Buick, okay? Three of them are things that people would expect. Beautiful cars that are very comfortable and really quiet. But to get on the luxury buyer's radar screen, we think that we have to, the performance needs to be part of our DNA. That doesn't mean we need to be Maserati, but we do need to have performance. And we need to do things like put manual transmissions in cars. Not necessarily because we're going to sell a lot of them, but because of what it says about us as a brand.
Gives you street cred, so to speak.
Yeah. And finally, the last one is technology. You know, by the end of next year, every single one of our vehicles will have IntelliLink. And, you know, there's a lot of technology that's going to roll out in our cars because that's something that luxury customers demand. They demand performance, they demand technology, and they want beautiful cars that are comfortable, and of course they want quiet cars.
Okay, and for those who don't know what IntelliLink is?
IntelliLink is our connected radio system. It's basically our connected infotainment system.
Yeah.
So how do you divide yourself from the person who might be considering a Cadillac?
The way that we've kind of carved ourselves up in terms of Cadillac is going to be much more performance oriented. So we're going to place a premium on the level of interior execution and the level of comfort and the level of quiet in the cars that we build with an acceptable good level of performance. Cadillac's going to be about world class performance in a luxury car. That's really the fundamental difference. In terms on a performance scale, they're going to have a little bit more technology than we are because they're at a higher price point as well.
See, I totally agree with the first three points, beautiful, comfortable, quiet. I'm not convinced on the performance part of it because Buick tried this in the 1980s. They did the T-types. Every model had a performance version T-type, and they were the best Buicks to drive. In fact, they were some of the best vehicles to drive in the General Motors lineup at the time. It did bring new people to the brand. It did lower the buying age, but long run, it just didn't work.
Yeah, it's more about being part of our DNA. As opposed to a trim level. In other words, you build the economy one, you build the kind of mid-level one, and then you build a performance one that's small part of your volume, okay? What it's about putting, you know, a really pretty good, acceptable level of performance in all of our vehicles, okay? And, yes, there'll be a Halo like a GS, which is a really fun car to drive and has a great powertrain in it, or a Verano Turbo with a manual. But it's not about creating a performance sub-brand. It's about it being part of the DNA of the brand overall.
So there won't be a Grand National rolling out anytime soon.
No, I got to tell you, I had the product job before I did the advertising and promotions job, and that was one of the debates in terms of the GS was what to call it. And I remember sitting in a conference room and debating whether or not we wanted to call it Grand National, and we decided that really didn't fit.
Smart move. It was not for that car.
It wasn't a long debate, but we did. It's not like we argued about it. But
you just had two of your engineers do that open road race in Nevada. Did you see that, John?
I did. And it got up to what, 172 miles an hour?
2 miles an hour, I think.
Now,
fastest Buick.
I know. And again, you know, I think it's great. It got you national coverage. I think a lot of people stood up and went, what, a Buick that can go 162?
But it's still a disconnect.
But I think it's a disconnect. I think it's the wrong
way. That part of it's about just building a little bit of credibility and, to be honest with you, having a little bit of fun.
Having a little bit of fun. Fun part's cool. And
I'm not going to make an ad out of 162 mile an hour GS.
Plus, they came in second, so... they were beaten by
you know, I talked to Ed Welburn a lot, and I've often talked to him, and he's often nodded in agreement that Buick needs Riviera again, a statement for the brand. And we noticed that he registered the name again. And so we're going to see a concept at Cobo Hall, right, called the Riviera.
That would be cool.
We do this all the time when we have people from the manufacturers.
That would be really cool. I don't know that they're working on anything right now. As a matter of course, we, you know, we kind of go through the list of our trademark names, and I wasn't actually involved in re-registering that trademark, but it was probably a good thing that we did.
Yeah.
You know, you were mentioning the, you know, the technology and the connectivity, and I'm going to cheat here. Consumer Reports came out with a survey this week about what people are looking for, shopping considerations for cars, and the thing that surprised me was that technology and infotainment and everything that OEMs seem to be beating us over our heads with doesn't come up on the list. 37% said fuel economy, 17% quality, 16% safety, 14% value, 6% performance. End of story. How do you read that?
Well, people want. If you ask somebody what's the most important thing in your car, well, it's got to be good quality, and it's got to get good fuel efficiency, and it's got to be a good value, and those are very practical, pragmatic kind of things. But that's not what makes you fall in love with a car. What makes you fall in love with a car is the performance of it, or the technology in it, or
design,
and those are very rational reasons for purchase.
Yeah, does anybody fall in love with sync? I mean, you know.
Yeah, but you know, I saw that survey too, and on Autoline Daily, I said, don't listen to what people tell the pollsters. Watch what they do in the showroom.
Yeah.
Watch what they buy.
Yeah, I noticed when you said that, John, and that's absolutely right. Watch what they buy.
Because they said, oh, yeah, I'll consider a hybrid, I'll consider an electric. That was very high consideration. I'll pay more for those kinds of vehicles. They don't do that. They tell the pollsters that because they think that's the right thing to tell them.
Well, it's the same in focus groups. They all, you know, you get in focus groups and they say what they think you want to hear. That's not what they want.
So but to be fair, I mean, look at the sales numbers for Prius so far this year, and they are pretty impressive.
Prius. Yeah. I've been a huge critic of the whole hybrid thing. Not criticizing the cars, but the overplay that the hybrids get. But I've said from the get-go, Toyota has cracked the code. They know how to sell hybrids. But guess what? The Prius is the only high-volume hybrid there is. Not even Toyota's other hybrids sell anywhere close to that. In fact, most of them don't even sell very well. So I agree. Prius, boom, they hit a home run.
So, I mean, so there is love. I mean, these people are not all
absolutely
people with pocket protectors who
but
are.
But when Consumer Reports comes out and says the vast majority of Americans only care about fuel economy and want hybrids and EVs, I know I'm oversimplifying what they said. I don't buy it because I went and I looked up, and small car sales year to date in the United States are up 11%. Pickups and SUVs are up 18%. So it's like I say, watch what people buy. Don't pay attention to what they tell the pollsters. I don't know, Craig, how do you guys buy it? You must pay attention to those polls anyway.
Well, sure. I mean, interesting. You said the thing about focus groups, Peter. And one of the things that we've noticed is we get that same kind of thing. And one of the things that we find to be actually more helpful in understanding consumers is actually one-on-ones in their homes.
Yeah, I know. I've read where you guys were doing that.
Yeah, we do a lot of that.
And that's better than a group think message you get out of a focus group.
We'll identify some of those
groups.
Focus
groups are a complete waste of time.
Why?
Because I sat through enough of them in my ad career to realize that it was total BS. And I remember one group. Now, this is in the, when GM was going down and we were in a focus group. And there was one group that was cranky, anti-GM, anti-domestic, all import and tenders. And I remember the client turning to me and said, we need to cut this group off. I said, no, I think we ought to send all the other groups home and focus on these people because, you know, we got to find out what's pissing them off. And, you know, that's what you guys need to focus on. And, you know, so I just don't see value. The one-on-one thing's interesting.
Yeah, we get
more value. It's got to be more value.
We get a tremendous. I mean, it's a little more. It's more labor intensive. Okay, but it is an incredibly valuable tool. You will be amazed at how much people reveal themselves in the comfort of their own home.
Well, that might be a good reality show.
Wow. Yeah.
You know, the Buick guys here.
Yeah. Ding dong.
Act normally.
But I mean, they'll tell you about you know the things that are going on in their everyday life that they just wouldn't do in front of seven of their peers.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And it gives us a much richer understanding of who this customer is. Well, and we found it incredibly useful in understanding the Buick customer. And what we found was kind of the stereotypical 1950s, 1960s ideal of what the Buick customer is. Okay, these people who were very community-minded, who really believed that they, even though they had a prominent role in the community, that the vehicle they drove said something about them, but they didn't want it to say too much about them. So they were, you know, and many times these were doctors and lawyers and bankers and some of the most wealthy people in town, but they drove Buicks because they didn't want to make that statement. I mean, the doctor's car analogy was basically this. It was, if he shows up in a Lincoln, he's charging me too much, because people used to pay. And if he shows up in a Dodge or a Ford or pick the mainstream brand, well, he must not be a very good doctor. So there was a delicate balance there. And what we found was is that these people...
Notice you didn't use Cadillac or Chevrolet as the other brands.
You could, you can, you know, sure.
Yeah.
I guess that was predicted, pretty predictable of me. But interestingly enough, these people that are buying Buicks today, and we only talk to people who are new to the brand, okay? People that were buying Enclaves and LaCrosses at the time that we did it, they're very much like those people.
They're very,
you know,
interesting.
They're very unassuming, unpretentious. They're very, in many cases, very, very successful, but they care about the world around them.
Well, shouldn't you be crafting marketing messages around that kind of mindset?
Well, that's what we are.
Oh,
that's what we are.
Okay.
I mean,
how old are these people?
12.
The people? I mean, how old are the people that we talk to? They're in their 40s and 50s.
That have this.
They're in their 40s.
So they're still boomers.
They're still boomers at
the very tail of that.
Well, mid to tail.
Because it would just seem to me that, you know, that other generations wouldn't be as self-effacing as these people seem to be. That they'd be a little bit more.
Yeah, they weren't
bold.
Really. They were very unpretentious. You know, very good people. I mean, when you go to somebody's house and they spend 3 hours preparing food for you to come and interview them and pay them, you know, I mean, they're very gracious, very kind, good-hearted people. And yes, it has affected the way that we've communicated to them. Absolutely has. I mean, the shorthand of the positioning is really we're a human kind of luxury. And what we're trying to be is more down-to-earth, more approachable, and a little bit more real than what a lot of luxury is, which is about being in an exclusive club. It's the difference between a luxury brand. It's the difference between driving a luxury brand and wearing a luxury brand. That's really what we're talking about.
Boy, that's a tough road of differentiation there, though.
I think
ultimately, like we've talked about, design is absolutely the most important thing, and you just have to have good looking vehicles before people even look at Buick.
Well, yeah,
because normally they're not going to seek Buick out, right?
I mean, no, just, and it's a, I mean...
If the LaCrosse, like we said, to this day...
Looks better than when it came out.
Yeah,
to my eye.
It looks of the moment right now, which is really good. And the Enclave is, you know...
Getting tweaked, because, boy, it's what been out in the market 5 years
Last
now.
Year was our fifth year, and it was our best year.
Which is amazing.
Yeah. So when the Enclave came out, besides the exterior, which was stunning, the big thing about the Enclave was the interior. To me, that was the first, not the first, but that was really GM design saying, we have got to ramp it up here. And the whole package was the most distinctive package in that segment. So it comes down to me, again, design, and you just have to have that wow factor on the street for people to consider you.
Yeah, but I've got to give up to his other brand, though. I think the Acadia was really well done.
Acadia's been tremendously successful.
Yeah, I mean,
we should mention for anybody listening who doesn't know, Craig Byerly also is the marketing manager for GMC, and Gary's referring to the GMC Acadia.
So, I mean, that's a really well done.
I mean, both of those vehicles have been tremendously successful for us. You know, the Acadia change that we made that'll come out later this year is even more significant than what we did on the Enclave. We made it a little more truck-like, and. We could not be more pleased with the way that they, you know, that they continue to sell.
I had an Acadia Denali for a week, and the thing, it's hard to find fault with it. I thought it was superb.
The only problem that you have is your sales are down, and I got to believe a lot of that has got to do, not because of your marketing, but you just don't have that many vehicles in the lineup
right now. It's Donald Trump's fault.
How so? You're just going to blame him on...
Yeah, I'll just blame him.
For everything.
Guilt by association.
GMC's up, though, right?
GMC's up. Buick is down a little bit.
How's Buick doing in China?
It's continuing to do really, really well.
You sell more Buicks in China than here?
Significantly more.
Yeah.
It's a larger market, too. It's a larger market, and...
Yeah, but you've had a long-standing reputation in China.
Yeah, I mean, we've been there since the 90s. So we've, you know, and we were there a long time ago before that.
Yeah, well, when the emperors embraced the Buicks, that people never forgot it.
Right, but our fleet business is down. Our fleet business is down 70%.
Wow.
Year over year. And we're doing that, and our incentive spending is down. I mean, this is, you know, publicly available information, but our incentive spending is down $800 a unit. Our residual values are up, so we're trying to make the brand stronger, okay, by doing less fleet, spending less in incentives, trying to drive more in the leasing portfolio because we think it's important to do that. That's why we did Experience Buick, the program, the two-year lease program with, you know, 2 years of OnStar, 2 years of XM, 2 years of maintenance, because we thought that was important to get a bigger lease portfolio and to get our dealers more engaged in the leasing business, because that's such an important part of what we're doing. So we're working on the residual end of it, and we're trying to make a healthier brand in the end. That's really what we're trying to do. And yes, we're confident that the sales are going to turn around.
Is it also that your showroom needs to be expanded a little bit?
Well, compared to other luxury makes, I mean, we outsell Acura, Infiniti, Lincoln, but you know, we're fourth among luxury brands, and we have fewer models. We have significantly fewer models.
Well, right now you have what? Four models, right?
Yeah.
Two cars, two trucks.
We have
three cars,
three sedans, one truck.
Right. So that's why I was saying that, that's got to hurt
a lot. There's clearly opportunity for us to continue to grow.
But you have the Encore coming.
The Encore's coming.
That's what, later this year?
The Encore will start production later this year, and they're really going to arrive next year.
Okay. And then you've got the redesign of the Enclave.
Right. That's coming as well.
So that ought to help a lot. And what you were saying before is amazing that in its fifth year, the Enclave is enjoying its best sales yet. And in fact, it's built every single year, because most cars come out, 2 years they do great, and then they start to tail off, and then they get redesigned.
The Enclave has been a fascinating thing to watch. There's a guy named Dennis House who is he's the anchorman on the CBS affiliate in Hartford, Connecticut. Really nice guy. Like, I met him at a New York Auto Show event that we had that you may have been at a couple years ago. We invited him down because he's such a Buick fan. Young guy, young wife, young kids, and he sends me this email. He sends Jim Federico and I this email. He says, you know, when we got our Enclave, we were the first people at the school to have an Enclave. I was sitting there this morning, and there were seven other Enclaves in the drive.
So it's catching on?
So, I mean, it continues to build. I mean, you know, we see this stuff all the time. We make advertising for it all the time. But to many people, it's still new.
Well, the thing about it, one thing the import manufacturers have done better than the domestics is when you have a hit like the Enclave, you don't lose your focus and get bored with it. You just keep making it better. That's how you establish it, you know, over model changes. I mean, Honda's done that, you know, when they used to be firing on all cylinders, they just kept constantly improving and people kept coming back. And that's one thing the domestics are starting to get now. They said, well, this is pretty good for us. We can't screw it up now. We've got to make it better, which is nice at what you're doing with the Enclave.
What's even more remarkable is that from when we introduced it to now, usually typically your average transaction prices decay over time. It's actually going up. So we're not only selling more, we're selling more at a higher price.
Why do you think that is, Craig? Why is it selling better? The residuals are up?
We're just becoming a stronger brand. We're able to get better pricing.
Is there more content in the vehicle?
Some, but some of it's just price.
How's the Verano working?
You know, the Verano, we're up to a little over 3,000 a month. It's on trend to where we want it to be. We're encouraged by it. We're still launching it. We're going to be launching it through the rest of this year. About 50% conquest.
Ooh. Wow.
When I had one, I was prepared to not like it, and I grudgingly liked it.
So
we think the turbo, when it comes out this fall, is going to help too.
Mm-hmm. And the 50% conquest, what are they coming out of? I mean, is it other GM products?
That's 50% to GM.
Okay. Wow.
So that's not 50% to Buick. These aren't Chevy people or old, you know, GMC people coming over. These are 50% new to the company coming in right now, and about half of them are coming out of imports. About half of them are coming out of domestics, and about half of them are coming out of imports.
Now, what's the turbo going to be called, or is it just going to have an option for a turbo?
It's just an option for a turbo.
Are you going to keep the Ventaports?
Yes.
What about the Encore? I thought it was pretty good, but I got to tell you, a lot of people that I walked around the auto show with at the Detroit show earlier this year did not like the look of the vehicle. I'm wondering what kind of a reaction you guys are getting.
Well, from our dealers, it's great. I mean, our dealers are really, really excited about it. I will tell you that it's another new name in a new segment, and really a new segment for North America. When you really break it down.
These are people who, they're not Buick buyers, so they wouldn't know what Buick's doing or anything like that. They didn't like the proportions. It's a very small crossover vehicle. They thought it looked too stubby, is the feedback that I got.
The best way that I can gauge reaction to this is how many leads I'm getting. And I don't do anything out of the ordinary to get leads on a launch car. So we don't run banners like, here, click here, or win this prize, or, you know, enter this contest to get leads, because those aren't very good. I mean, so why clutter the dealer system up with a bunch of unqualified leads? So we just grow them organically. And we've, at this point, compared to where we were with Verano, same introduction time, we have twice as many leads.
Oh. Now, is that the same size as the BMW X1?
It's about the same size.
That's going to be interesting.
It's about the same size. It's similar in size to, like, a Qashqai.
Mm-hmm. Which is just tearing up the European market, right? Yeah. Qashqai is doing very well over
there. Yeah, they just announced an increase in production in Russia of that vehicle. Hmm. And the X1, they have the new plant in China that went online today.
For the X1?
For the X1. And the your favorite car, the Stretch 3 Series.
So what else? What are we missing here, Craig, that we haven't talked about at Buick?
We're launching Verano. I will tell you that if I can brag a little bit, we just picked up a bronze Effie for the human highlight reel.
And explain what an Effie is.
It's based on marketing effectiveness. It's an award. And we got it not for the business, but we got it for really what is a cause-related effort that we're working on. Knowing that this customer and this target really does care about the world around them. We had to find a place after we got out of golf to be big. And because we needed a big stage. Every brand needs its place where it can be big once or twice a year. We thought the NCAA made a lot of sense. And it's an alumni audience. It's not a college kid audience, okay? It's a passionate alumni audience. The men's basketball tournament made a lot of sense for us to be involved in. We're a corporate partner with the NCAA. What we find is that if we build contextual content around a sponsorship like that, that our marketing messages for our products actually resonates better. So not only the billboards and the in-program placements that you get, but the fact that we developed this other content. The human highlight reel is basically, to give you it in a nutshell, is we created a site with the NCAA, ncaa.com/Buick, where we tell the stories of former NCAA athletes. We thought it was important that they be former NCAA athletes who've done amazing things in the world after they graduated from college. And it's not just about famous athletes donating money to charity. It's about people like Manny Ahome, who founded an organization called Samaritan's Feet, that literally it's all he does now, and he's donated nearly 4 million pairs of shoes to children all over the world. Mm.
You know, so it's great stories.
It's great stories.
Great stories, great human interest.
It's great compelling content.
And how's that working for you?
I mean, it's great. I mean, we had, you know, a couple hundred thousand people visit the site. We've had over 500,000 people, you know, view the content. And they have a better opinion of us as a brand after viewing it. Hmm. You know, the NCAA in total for us, because it's high engagement programming and because of all the other things that we do with it, we see more than a doubling in the lift of breakthrough. Okay, so people taking attention and paying attention to our ads, so it becomes much more effective for us, and we couldn't be more pleased with the way that it's worked for us, and we're going to build on it. We're going to do some things in the fall with college football that we're still putting together, and we'll be back in the men's basketball tournament again next year. So, you know, a great property and great platform, and clearly was controversial when we got out of golf. Because, I mean, we were probably more than any other brand association with one sport. I mean, Buick and golf was...
For many, many years.
For many, many years.
Well, congratulations on the Effie.
Thanks. That's great.
Hey, why don't we take another commercial break here? We'll come back and do rapid fire. So, Ben, let's give a shout-out to our friends at Chevrolet.
It was more than a car to him. It really was his baby. Oh, no. That's my old Chevy. Dear God.
Great ad. Great ad.
Okay, it's time for rapid fire. Ben, bring it on. Okay, Craig, the first question to you comes from a guy who goes by the moniker 98 Regency, who asks, will Buick come out with a large car like a Park Avenue, and in parentheses he says China, or Roadmaster-type vehicle?
We don't have any plans at this time.
Okay, VRM Chris says, will the 1.6 turbo that's sold in the Opel line be sold here? Seems to be the perfect addition or replacement for the 2.4 liter.
I honestly don't know the answer to that.
Okay, maybe you don't know this one either. Mike DeWhite says, will the Verano get the new 2.5 four-cylinder soon?
Not soon.
Okay. Why is the Encore a Buick and not a GMC?
Well, I mean, from its inception, it was concepted as a Buick. And so it fits the DNA of what we want a Buick to be. We think it's beautiful. We think it's incredibly quiet. And for something that small, it's still going to be remarkably comfortable.
Will it launch here first, or will it launch in China?
Simultaneously.
Boy, and I can tell you, it is quiet. That car is very impressively quiet. It's got to be the quietest car of its size. I'm not even saying class. I'm just saying of its size.
What, Verano?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's amazing.
Okay, we got some phone calls coming in here. Ben, let's bring the first one in.
Now, this is John Dunlap from the Ozarks in Missouri. I'd like to know one thing, what you all think is the greatest car that Shelby ever got behind. I'd like to hear your thoughts on it. Thank you. Bye.
Peter, you want to start?
Well, my personal favorite was the small block Cobra, the first one.
There 289.
Was, well, yeah, there was the 260.
Oh, 260.
And then, but the 289 was my favorite. Everyone speaks about the 427, and it was awesome, but to me, the essence of the Shelby legacy is that first Cobra.
Yeah, I would say if people haven't read what you wrote about Shelby, they ought to go and read your piece because it, in the pictures, it's fabulous.
Thanks.
Yeah, and I would agree with you. I think the 289 Cobra was great. The 427 was just way more power than the car could handle.
Oh, it was awesome. It was just something about that first smaller one was...
Although, as we talked about last week, too, the Daytona Coupe was the coolest Shelby effort ever.
Stunning car.
Okay. Comment from Sean says, why is Buick still here and Pontiac is dead? You care?
Well,
I can answer that one.
You want to answer that? Go ahead.
They were both losing money in the U.S., but Buick was making gobs of money in China. GM wasn't going to walk away from a super strong brand in the fastest, biggest market in the world.
That's an absolutely right, pragmatic way of looking at it. The other thing is, and I worked on Pontiac, and when we did focus groups on Pontiac, and we did focus groups on Buick, we did focus groups on Pontiac and with competitive owners. Okay, we get import owners in there, and they would speak disparagingly about Pontiac and about the people who drove them. When we did Buick groups with import owners, they would speak fondly about Buicks.
Really?
They would speak fondly in the sense of Buicks might not be for me, but my dad, my uncle, some cherished loved one had one, always drove them.
My father's last car was a Roadmaster, so.
And to me, that answered the question. That's not why it happened, but to me, that answered the question, okay? Buick was a brand that had more potential.
Wow, Craig, I've never heard that. That's brilliant. That you just made the whole show for me. That's very interesting.
If I had $5 billion, I'd still buy Pontiac the rights from General Motors, and I'd make it sing.
Well, you know what has to be done with that.
Yeah.
Let's see. Goggles Pisano says, "Will there be another Cyclone Typhoon-like vehicle in GMC's future?"
Not in the foreseeable future.
Man, those were two of the coolest vehicles of all time.
They were very cool.
And, boy, I think they're collector items. The Typhoon especially, I always get them confused. The Typhoon was the SUV-like one, or was that the pickup one?
No, the pickup was the Cyclone.
Yeah, the Typhoon was the SUV.
And, you know, it was almost hard to lay a patch in that thing with as much power as it had because of the all-wheel drive. That thing just shot out of the hole like nothing you could believe. I mean, those were cool vehicles.
Well, speaking of GMC, I mean, you've got a big launch coming up with the Sierra. Right?
Sure do.
That's got to be enormous.
Yeah, when is that?
We're going to launch that next year.
Because, you know, all we hear is the hand-wringing about the dealers, how many pickups they're ordering, and they either have too many or they don't have enough because of the changeover. Isn't the changeover like...
Changeover's next year.
But it's 5 months, isn't it?
It takes a while. It takes a while. I mean, the number of plants, the number of cab configurations, you bring heavy duties on, and that's unlike what we've normally done. Typically, we've done a light-duty launch, and then a year or two later, we do a heavy-duty launch. We're going to do them all in 1 year.
Wow. Yeah, that's a big undertaking.
What's the rationalization behind that?
To get them out. Sell more.
Yeah. I mean, got to knock off that F-150 or F-Series, and only new product will do that.
The truck looks great. We were at Milford this afternoon looking at them, and the truck looks, we're really excited about it. It's going to be a great truck.
Good. Ben, we got another phoner. Let's bring it in.
Hi, this is Mike from Vermont again, and while I can understand the economic motivation for Mazda with this limited tie-up with Fiat, does this delay the next generation Miata? Does it dilute the Miata brand? After all, wasn't Mazda already positioning itself to be the alpha of the Japanese manufacturers when you look at its upcoming design? Again, great work, guys. Look forward to it each week. Bye.
Good question.
I think it accelerates the possibility of the Miata rather than...
What are they saying, 2015 for the new Miata?
I think, yeah. Because, I mean, just imagine if you had to try to pay for all the engineering you'd need for that new car. So this will be the third one, like, in 25 years or something. I mean, they don't do those very often. And so by having the infusion of whatever from Fiat, well, remains to be seen, but...
He may be right. It may delay the car because, you know, now Fiat and Mazda have got to get together.
Well, you've got to build in about 10 months of hand-wringing at least,
right.
10 to 15 months of mutual hand-wringing.
Yeah, but there's all those guys who are working on the RX-7 who now have nothing to do, therefore they can go over and work on the...
But remember, was it Ralph Jules when he was here was saying that, you know, the Chrysler and Fiat engineers just had to figure out what they really wanted to achieve because in Europe, with smooth roads, higher cornering speeds, lateral forces are what they really worry about in suspension design. In the United States, with bad pavement and bigger, heavier vehicles, vertical forces is what they're more worried about. But getting back to the whole Miata thing, there may not be a new Miata whatsoever unless they split the cost with Fiat. So
yeah, I'll reiterate that Sergio has designs on Mazda. There's no question.
Uh-huh. Okay, another question for you, Craig, from Rum and Coke, who says, I'm sure lots of potential Buick sales were stolen by Lexus over the last two decades. Now that Lexus looks weak and vulnerable, is Buick going to directly target current and potential Lexus owners?
Every day.
Especially with the new Riviera.
Yeah. I mean, every day. I mean, you know, we view Lexus as a direct competitor.
Do you see them as vulnerable?
I'm not sure how vulnerable I think Lexus is. I think they're an incredibly strong brand. They're a great competitor, and we have a lot of work to do. We're making progress, but we still have a lot of work to do.
And you guys were running ads, what was it, a year or two ago that specifically called them out? It was calling the Germans out.
It was the May the Best Car Win.
Yeah.
It was the May the Best Car Win campaign, and we had a LaCrosse and an ES in the spot. It'll be 3 years this fall.
Okay.
Scott in Cleveland wants to know, is the Granite concept still being considered for production, or has that been scrapped?
Oh, we'd love to do that, but it's a matter of putting the case together to do it.
Figuring out how to make
Is there a market for things like that, do you think? Or is it gone down?
That's the tough part about putting something together.
It's kind of like the Hummer H4.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you know, we clearly think that we think innovation is part of the DNA of GMC. We think it has to be part of the professional grade engineering, that this idea that, you know, we build these vehicles that help make you better and help you perform better. that innovation is key to that, and there are so many innovations in granite that there's got to be some of that that we can pick off and use other places too. So,
Tony Gray wants to know, does Buick need a convertible?
Need or
another one you'd love to do?
We'd sure like that, but that's another thing we have to evaluate based on what the market potential is and what it costs us to do it.
After they do the Riviera Coupe, let's do the Riviera convertible.
And I'm starting to believe
I'm a marketing guy. I'd love more stuff to sell, you know.
Mike DeWitt wants to know, why are Buick GMC showrooms getting paired with Chevrolet? There are two like that in my area.
He's probably in a smaller town. Our preferred channeling arrangement is Chevrolet standalone, Cadillac standalone, and a Buick GMC dual. In smaller markets, we do have instances where Buick, Chevrolet, and GMC are all together.
George from Brooklyn asks, how much has the Chinese market influenced Buick design?
In varying degrees. I mean, we have a great partnership and collaboration with the team in China. And so the design resources there, their voice is clearly, you know, part of the development of all of our vehicles. We spend a lot of time talking to them about any number of things, whether that's contenting strategies, the future product portfolio, all of that is stuff that we partner with them and work on. And, you know, clearly... Ed's got design centers all over the world and putting into our cars. So, I mean,
wasn't the LaCrosse the first calculated one to sort of aimed at the Chinese market and actually do with it?
Yeah, if I'm not mistaken, I think the interior was actually designed right. at Paytac over there. So, and it was designed, and the rear seat accommodations were actually designed specifically for the fact that so many people that ride in the car in China are actually sitting in the back seat.
That's what the future is, large rear seats for all cars.
No, no, it's just...
There'll be tiny little fronts for us to drive. There'll be these giant... I mean, all vehicle manufacturers are doing it. I mean, yeah. It's crazy.
Okay, we've got some more phone calls. Let's go with the next one, Ben.
Hi, this is Victor from Cleveland. Peter is correct. Your Buick guest needs to pay attention to how its ads antagonize customers. The two Buick ads previously presented are emblematic of why I will currently never buy a Buick for myself or for my family. These ads are androgynous, showing men as dolts or ineffectual idiots, and are a turnoff for me as a customer. The androgyny in your current ads is self-defeating. Any comments?
I'm not sure what ad he's talking about, so...
I don't know. I don't know.
Well, maybe you're going after a new segment that we don't know about.
Yeah.
The androgynous segment.
Our advertising, I will tell you that this, the same reason why we made the decision that we did on Facebook was based on analytics. We spent a lot of time working on the analytics side of our advertising, and some of our advertising is the best performing advertising we've had. It's about finding a new audience. It's about connecting with them, and clearly it's about breakthrough. I'm at a loss to figure out... If I don't know what the ad is that he's talking about, I'm at a loss to react
and
to it.
If you don't know, I sure don't.
But you know, clearly, we've done some work we're incredibly proud of. The e-assist work that we used to introduce the LaCrosse, where people were running in place, was a powerful metaphor for the idea that why does your engine have to run when you're stopped? Because why when you're stopped, you know, running in place. Seems like it's kind of a silly thing to do. And we thought that was a really interesting way to break through and to get people to lean in a little bit because, you know, that's the challenge that all of us as marketers have is to find higher engagement programming, to find a way to connect with people and a way to get people to stop what they're doing and go, wow, that's not what I thought Buick was about.
So what are you spending on Buick advertising marketing?
Not enough.
You know, it's funny.
Not enough is just I'm being sarcastic, but, you know.
I've never met a marketing person who thought they had all the budget that they need.
No, I mean, you know, I mean, clearly, you know, we think we're adequately resourced. Could we spend more? Sure. You know, do when we go into budgets every year, do we ask for, you know, more resources? Absolutely. It's not necessarily so much what I'm tasked with is, to take the resources that we have and make it work as hard as I can. And that's where a lot of the powerful analytics come in. And, you know, we copy. You know, we don't design things to copy test. We copy test them. And sometimes we find that we can make an ad better based on listening to what consumers have to say, because ultimately, at the end of the day, that's who we're trying to influence. We think we got a pretty nice rhythm going on some of the Buick work because it seems to be working. I mean, we came up with a spot that used the band The Neon Trees to talk about Pandora and do it in a way that was, you know, clearly an unexpected way to show Pandora, having a bunch of tour buses following a woman around doing her everyday chores.
That's a great ad. That's a very effective ad.
You know, and it broke through. I mean, just anecdotally here locally, not too far from here, at Sellers down the road here, we actually know of a guy in his 30s who came in and bought a car just because he likes The Neon Trees and because that ad got his attention.
Huh.
So that caller isn't going to be doing that anytime soon.
No, no. But maybe you ought to look and see what he means by the
I'm sorry, but I'm at a loss on that one.
Hey, we got another phoner, Ben. Let's bring it in.
Dudes, this is Youngblood, Cleveland, Ohio. Got a question for Mr. GMC. Is there any kind of full-size half-ton pickup coming out? There seems to be a pretty big hole there. I was wondering if GMC might be the one to take advantage of it. And I forgot last week, happy 151 this week.
Thanks, Youngblood. Yeah.
Full-size half-ton pickup?
No, was he asking about a mid-size pickup?
I thought he said full-size.
Oh, full-size?
He said full-size half-ton pickup.
Yeah.
You already make that.
We make one and we're going to do a new one.
I wonder if he misspoke himself. When he said there's a big hole in the market there, was he referring to a mid-size pickup?
I don't know.
I don't know.
Well, there is a new Colorado.
Could he be talking about a front-wheel drive?
But is the Colorado coming here?
Yeah. Didn't GM just announce an expansion of the plant in Missouri to build them?
I didn't hear that.
Okay. Maybe I'm wrong. Anyway, here's another question for you. Brian says, kudos for tonight's guest. Thank you for continuing to give Buick's actual names and not the alphanumeric soup that has been in vogue with other brands. Will you continue to name new Buicks, or do you see alphanumeric names in Buick's future?
Names.
Yeah, names.
Words.
Good.
Riviera.
Yeah.
Well, do you think if you say it often enough, it'll begin to penetrate?
It's one of the great all-time car names, right?
I love it, Peter.
And it was an iconic design statement in the 60s, and I've talked to Ed Welburn about this a lot. And he agrees.
So Jay Cujo says, for Craig, in a recent article, it stated that the most popular color of the Verano was the red tint coat. Consumers said that it was the only color, not black, silver, or white. Looking at 2013, your whole lineup only offers, really, three colors other than silver, black, and white. Break the mold, please, and offer me some color.
Well, we continue to, you know, we've got new colors coming every year, but we're down to a limited number of colors based on, you know, complexity and how much complexity that drives in manufacturing. And so, you know, we continue to try to find new colors. I mean, one color that's doing pretty well that, you know, 5 years ago we couldn't have given away is there's a dark blue. That's doing terrific. But, I mean, 5 years ago, you couldn't sell dark blue cars.
How interesting. So you know, people's tastes do change.
You know, I mean, it's doing great on the Enclave. People's tastes change, but silver, white, black.
Dominate.
You know, those are staples. I mean, that's, when you brought up the reasons for purchase, I mean, in many respects, people are very pragmatic about the kind of colors that they want to drive to.
Okay, we've got a few more phoners. Ben, let's bring it on.
Hi, Jim Campbell calling from Calgary, Alberta, Canada. Just calling with regards to your pollster comments. Wasn't there a survey or a research thing done by Chrysler back in, I think, the late 50s, early 60s, where they asked what kind of car they would like to see, and the customers or consumers were saying, well, they would like these conservative-looking vehicles and all this kind of stuff. And then they said, well, what kind of car would your neighbor buy? And then they said about with all the fins and the chrome and all of this styling. And Chrysler went with that, and it turned out to be a success. They went with what the neighbors would buy. Have a great day. Great show.
Very interesting. Yeah. Maybe you get that kind of comparison between focus groups and a focus group think versus the one-on-one in people's homes where you really get the truth out of them.
Yeah, I mean, they're much more candid and much more forthcoming, and it's just... Plus, you get a feel for the way they live their lives.
You know, you spend some time in somebody's house, just look around.
How do you find these people?
Yeah.
We recruit them. I mean, you know, we'll recruit them. We have, what we really start with is a target persona. We call them, for Buick, we call them passionate experientials. We know how to recruit those people. There's a battery of questions. We can tell if you're a passionate experiential or not. You own a qualifying vehicle. And then we'll call you up and ask you if you'll do it. Typically, we do them not to validate advertising concepts, but to understand the target market and the way that we're going to launch a new car. So that's really how we use it. We use it to get a pretty in-depth understanding of who the target market is for the Encore, for example. We just finished some on Encore. To understand that customer, their needs, how we want to communicate, and then that informs the way we communicate with them.
Since this is a different model, how do you describe to them what it is exactly that you're talking about beyond, I mean, showing them or putting pictures?
Yeah, we show them pictures. And, yeah. You know, I mean that's pretty much what you have to be able to do. You know, you give them an idea how big it is and talk to them about the level of content and so the features of the car. And they already own something that's a relatively small SUV, and they have expressed an interest in even going smaller. Hmm. That's how we do that. Mm-hmm.
I like what the caller just said, though, about asking, okay, what do you think your neighbor would buy? I think that's a very clever way of questioning
that's
people.
That's an interesting question. It sure is.
Ben, do I read this right? We got another phone call.
Hi, this is George from Sunnyvale, California. On the topic of technology in Buicks, and particularly in the LaCrosse, the heads-up display is a great item to have. Wish other vehicles had it. But you have to be careful about technology. For example, the center stack in the LaCrosse is way too complex, way too many buttons, and the owner's manual that goes through how to operate it is terrible. You have to have the center stack has to be intuitive, sort of like an Apple product where you don't even need the manual to use it. So thank you.
Yeah, thanks for the comment.
Couldn't agree more. Couldn't agree more. I mean, the IntelliLink interfaces give us an opportunity to be a little bit more simple, a little more intuitive, and because it's so much of it's software, we can continue to refine it and make it better, make it easier to use.
Okay, we're going to wrap up the show, except that here's a topic that we did not get into, and this one goes to you, Peter, because Mitch W. wants to know, what should I watch at Indy? Because that's this Sunday, yeah. 500.
Well, everyone's talking about the Penske versus Andretti. First of all, the Chevrolet engines are just more than a little tick better than Honda's. Race day, it's a whole different thing. Qualifying, they were definitely better. So the winner's going to come from Penske or Andretti. But my dark horse is the rookie, 21-year-old rookie from Tennessee, Joseph Newgarden, who is driving for Sarah Fisher Racing.
A smaller team.
Very small. It's this year's Cinderella story. Look for Joseph Newgarden to be a factor on Sunday. Kids special.
I totally agree. I think he's been the sensation of the season. He's had some bad luck. He might have podiumed for sure, maybe even have won a race. Who knows? But I totally agree. I think this kid is really, really the real deal because in a lesser team with a Honda engine, which, as you just mentioned, are just not quite as fast as the Chevys right now, he's done some magical things.
He was quickest, I think, in three practice days, and he was always in the top 10. So it could be interesting Sunday. It's a wide-open race, by the way.
I would agree.
Also, it's going to be the hottest temperature of any Indy race in history, the hottest since I think 1937. It's going to be 95 degrees, and that means a greasy track, so it's going to be interesting.
The other thing I think that we're going to see is within five laps you're going to see a number of cars black flagged because they're simply not fast.
The two Lotus entries, too bad. Jean Alesi, former Formula One
star, driver, right?
Even though race speeds are down from practice, they're still going to be 10 miles an hour to 12 miles an hour slower, and that's just too slow. So
I wish
got to get a paycheck.
Yeah,
I wish Indy had allowed the Lotus teams to boost the turbo.
They should have
made them more competitive. Do something.
Yeah,
You know,
the Lotus problem is the problem with the Lotus itself. It's cratering financially, and they haven't spent the money on development of that engine. And if you don't spend the money on engine development, then you're nowhere. So,
I think it's going to be an exciting race. And like you, I think it's wide open.
Yeah,
it's wide open because of the heat. Because there's going to be probably a lot of attrition because of that. Who knows who might win?
Yeah,
could be cool.
Yeah.
Good. Okay, I'm glad that he asked the question.
Yeah, me too.
I'm glad that we got that. But yeah, we'll wrap it up. So Craig Byerly from Buick and GMC, thanks so much for coming in.
Hey,
really interesting discussion. Some great
thanks,
stuff. And Gary, great having you back on the show, as always. As Peter says, we love when people come prepared. He's done his homework. That's so good. But Peter and I will continue just to wing it as we do every week. Well, that's not entirely true, but it's a funny line. I want to thank everybody for having tuned in, and we'll see you again next week.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion, and by Chevrolet. Chevy runs deep.